Morning Crossfire on 99.3 Nigeria Info.
We are the nation's number one talk station, 99.3 Nigeria Info, Lagos, Nigeria. Good morning to you. It's 5 minutes past the hour. No, scratch that. It's 6 minutes now. Past the hour of eight. You can watch live on Facebook and on YouTube this morning. Feel free to join us on those two platforms. We would appreciate you to follow our conversation this morning on the show. I am Sheriff Kwame, by the way. What else? So elections are getting closer and closer. It's and elections, they have consequence. So please ensure that you listen very closely to what the politicians are saying at this point in time. Don't get distracted for no reason. And please ensure that you ask the right questions, because that's the only way you can get to decide, have an informed decision when you go to the polls next year, 2023. Right. So this morning, though, we're not talking election. We're talking something even more serious. We're talking existential threat. We're talking about humanity. We're talking about, you know, our life as a people. We're talking COP27. We're talking the climate change. We're talking, you know, how the world is right now. And to give proper perspective to this conversation, take a listen to the UN General Secretary while he was speaking at the COP27 opening the other day. Take a listen to this. I'll be back.
In just days, our planet's population will cross a new threshold. The 8 billionth member of our human family will be born. This milestone puts into perspective what this climate conference is all about. How will we answer when baby 8 billion is old enough to ask, what did you do for our world and for our planet when you had the chance? Excellencies, this UN climate conference is a reminder that the answer is in our hands. And the clock is ticking. We are in the fight of our lives, and we are losing. Greenhouse gas emissions keep growing. Global temperatures keep rising. And our planet is fast approaching tipping points that will make climate chaos irreversible. We are on a highway to climate hell, with our foot still on the accelerator.
We are on a highway to climate hell with our foot still on the accelerator. Joining me on the show this morning is the British Deputy Commissioner, High Commissioner in Lagos here, Ben Llewellyn Jones. He joins me live in the studio. Mr. Ben, good morning to you.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
It's always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
You had the UN chief saying that we're on the highway to climate hell. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think that the Secretary General sets it out so clearly. You know, we can see the visible impacts of climate change. We experience them in Lagos, but across Nigeria and Bayelsa and Kogi, we know what is happening. These aren't imagined or things that might happen in the future. They're happening now. So what the UN Secretary General is pointing to, what we're pointing to, is the need not just to talk about action, but to commit to and take action. Mm. And COP27, which is happening as we speak in Sharm el-Sheikh, is where world leaders, including Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, come together to try and not just restate commitment, but deepen commitment and also provide the climate finance that can make commitment real and happen. And, you know, at COP26 in Glasgow last year, we agreed the Glasgow Climate Pact, which was intended to reduce world temperatures, global temperatures still further. In 2015, we agreed the Paris Climate Agreement.
Yeah.
But that would have kept temperatures at about 3 degrees.
Mm.
And we've seen that's too high. So what's happening in COP27 is not just people talking. It's about making the roadmap possible and making the finance available to make that road travelable.
Mm. You know, I want to understand whether, you know, Lagos, whether Nigeria, actually even understand the crux of our conversation this morning, because it's important for us to, you know, try and weigh their understanding of climate change. So please feel free to call in if there is any question at all, if you have any doubts whatsoever as regards climate change and climate change conversation. Please feel free, you know, to chime in and let us know, you know, the concerns that you have. I would love to hear from you. Okay, now let's move further, because this time I'm really more interested in some other areas of this conversation. Please tell me, what was the UK's role in 2022? As the COP presidency, you mentioned Glasgow, and that was in 2022, right? What was the UK's role there?
So in Glasgow, COP26, just last year, we were the COP presidency, announced as the COP presidency. So yeah. we chaired the COP, the Conference of Parties, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, all world leaders coming together.
Right.
And we agreed this Glasgow Climate Pact, which 195 countries signed up to, and 95% of the developed economies signed up to, in terms of their climate approach and their climate targets. So what we've been doing since then as COP presidency is driving forward implementation of that agreement. How are people doing it? Are they meeting their commitments? Mm. What would make them meet their commitments? How do you get businesses to do this? So we handed over the baton to our Egyptian colleagues in Sharm el-Sheikh.
Yeah.
But right up to that point, and even now, we're there driving the conversation forward to make people do what they say and say what they do.
Hmm. Do you think the parties have been doing what they say they would do? Do you believe that?
I think since COP26 and the world's a challenged place. The illegal Russian war in Ukraine has definitely challenged.
I was going to talk to you about that, but exactly. Please go on.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's definitely challenged how people wanted to proceed. You know, it's had an immediate shock on energy prices globally, not just in Europe. It's had an immediate impact on the kind of trajectory people were hoping to take around energy transition. Mm. But what I think it's also done, and our Prime Minister said this very, very clearly, it's also focused people on why transition to renewable energy is so important. We can't depend on fossil fuels. They're challenged by not just wars, but by the climate impacts. They're expensive now. We need to move to cheaper, more efficient, more accessible renewable sources. So I think people have had to readjust, and certainly countries are readjusting, and that's, you know, that's real, that's happening. But I think it's focused people on why it's important to move.
How badly has the war in Ukraine affected that zeal, that vigor, that drive towards climate change effort by especially the European countries? Because now they've gone back to coal, which is not a clean energy source, by the way.
I think there has been some need to invest short term in traditional fossil fuels, coal, but also in gas. And that's happened. We'd seen it. But I think it's also shown those countries that a dependence on gas particularly, and even coal, is not sustainable. It's not going to help. It's not going to work. Mm. And so actually, I think it's shown countries that were perhaps not comfortable, but uncomfortable with moving quickly. Okay. But moving quickly is the only way towards energy transition.
Indeed. Now, let's talk about moving quickly. This time, I want us to go to Sharm el-Sheikh. How did the UK work with Egypt as a COP 27 presidency?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a partnership. So with our different voices, our different reaches around the world, we've been trying to talk to countries. I think for Egypt, this COP is specifically about Africa.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, really important and powerful, and a focus on adaptation, a focus on climate finance, of course, but also a focus on action that's being taken in Africa. So I think we've had a partnership, different reaches, different diplomatic kind of constituencies, but working together to try and get the Glasgow Pact, but also, frankly, countries who are not necessarily as committed to the Glasgow Pact to see why, for Africa, this really matters. Mm. Africa is historically not responsible for the world's global emissions, but Africa is experiencing the impact and is one of the most vulnerable continents that is experiencing the impact. So a really powerful moral voice, and I think Egypt's been harnessing that moral voice, which is really important.
I mean, great stuff that the Egyptian government has been doing concerning climate change. But let's talk about Africa and COP27 and the role. I'm glad that you mentioned that, you know, Africa as a continent hasn't been a major contributor to climate change and all of that. But then you still find activities going on by developed world come to Africa, do some mining operations here and there, degrading society. The other day, I think it was, what's his name now? Elon Musk, who wanted to come to Nigeria to mine cobalt for his electric car batteries and all of that. And Africans are saying that, look, we're not major contributors to climate change. This shouldn't be our problem. If you want it to be our problem, there's got to be some reasonable level of financing, because the number one problem of African countries now is poverty. If we can bring some balance, if we can bring poverty to a reasonable low level, then maybe we can start talking about climate change to be fully a participant in COP. But my question is, whatever African countries say at COP27 and, you know, the subsequent COPs that will come up, do you believe that Africans can actually make any reasonable impact?
Definitely. So, I mean, firstly, on mining, what we're doing with energy transition is not stopping all activity that requires large-scale energy. Mining's going to be essential for electric vehicles. Where those minerals are found, it's important to mine. We need to have energy to do large-scale mining to ensure we can have the technology to allow us to do energy transition. So in Europe, in Africa, in Asia, this is going to be part of the solution. It's not just, a challenge, it's part of the solution. I think when it comes to Africa's not just voice but action, definitely there's evidence, not just outside of Nigeria but in Nigeria, of businesses that are taking action to move towards energy transition. Sterling Bank here in Lagos is sheened with solar panels. More businesses could do this. This is not just a good thing to do, it's an affordable thing to do.
Right.
There's plenty of off-grid energy solutions in Nigeria. There's plenty of renewable energy companies who are making it work and showing how this is not just affordable but practical for constituencies. So in many ways, Africa is the vanguard of solutions. The challenge is scale, as you say. It's not just poverty, it's energy access. The sheer number of people in Nigeria who've never had reliable energy access.
Right. That's right.
And we can't, as we have a just energy transition, ignore that problem. So I think it's not about the history of emissions in Africa. It's about the trajectory. What we don't want is for people to have energy access at the expense of the planet and create the kind of climate impacts that are going to destroy their world. So it's about how to make energy transition happen in a way that allows for energy access but doesn't put Africa and Nigeria on a kind of high-emitting pathway in a way that would destroy the world. Because we know by 2050 the world needs to be net zero. That's what we need to do.
That's right.
How do we do that? That's the question.
Talking about net zero emission status, Nigeria, for instance, said they need about over $1 trillion to achieve that in 2060. Do you think that's ever going to be possible? I mean, looking at all the other areas Nigeria needs to focus its resources on, is that even achievable?
I think it can be achievable. I think a number of steps need to be taken to make it achievable. Firstly, much of the money that may be spent on climate change is private investment. It's private sector investment. So the investment climate in Nigeria needs to be able to attract that. Unfortunately, at the moment, foreign direct investment in Nigeria is declining. We need to reverse that. Conditions that would attract investment need to be created. So for businesses that want to look at infrastructure projects in Nigeria, they need to see a return on their capital. That's very possible. It's very possible. But that needs to change. I mean, secondly, I think we need to look at some of the constraints that challenge investment around energy. The fuel subsidy, to be honest, is one of those. I totally understand why it's a very difficult thing to remove, why there's a lot of sentiment around it.
Right.
But, it is at the moment a deterrent to many companies thinking about renewable energy in Nigeria. So how do we change that? And then thirdly, for me, I think it's about allowing the kind of innovation that can get energy to parts of Nigeria that currently are so inaccessible for energy or challenged indeed by security.
Right.
So very doable, but a challenge.
Earlier, you talked about flooding in Nigeria. What's the UK government doing?
Well, we have committed through multilateral sources about £500,000 to support immediate impact of people who are experiencing flooding across Nigeria. And over the last few months, we've seen terrible incidents of that, visibly people impacted, deaths and so on. And that in itself is a tragedy. But away from the immediate, which is important, we're also, through our development programs, supporting investment in infrastructure, climate resilient infrastructure that would be able to withstand some of these impacts. Very difficult to do that. And then thirdly, and importantly, over the long term, we announced just yesterday a £95 million program to focus on agriculture and to develop climate-resistant and climate-adapted seeds and agriculture that can support people to farm in the new climate. Because one of the challenges we have is we can try and reduce global temperatures, but global temperatures have risen and will still rise.
Right.
So we need to farm and produce in a different way in flooded or in drought-ridden conditions. And we need more, and there are more people as well. There's going to be more people living in those circumstances.
Now, speaking of climate change more broadly, Mr. Ben, this morning, and this question is quite direct, though. What is the UK government doing in Nigeria around this, speaking about climate change broadly now?
So broadly, so not just the £95 million agriculture program, which, as I say, will support 4 million people, 2 million women specifically, will look at climate-resistant seeds, climate-resistant agriculture. We also have a climate finance accelerator program, which is intended to try and catalyze that climate finance to try and help businesses to have kind of shovel-ready projects that climate finance can come towards.
Right.
We've worked with Nigerian public and private institutions to produce six green bonds, raising about $165 million, again, to be used in climate-resistant infrastructure.
Mm.
We're working now with the Nigerian authorities to produce an integrated resource plan to make the energy transition plan Nigeria has to make this 2060 target real happen, so that companies that want to invest in energy know what they can do, they understand the circumstances, the investment climate, and so on. So there's plenty that we're doing. There's always more that can be done.
And that's
from our perspective, it's not just about what the UK or indeed donors are doing. We need to see businesses, Nigerian businesses, embrace this energy transition. And we've been working with Nigerian businesses to try and get them to sign up to net zero targets and really walk the walk and talk the talk on this, because that's where I think in Nigeria a lot of that creativity and innovation will come from.
There's really nothing, I'm going to talk to you about government policies and your belief that, you know, all those long-term plans that the UK government, you know, has embarked on concerning working with Nigeria and Nigerian government on climate and all. Now, all these plans, eventually, they come to fruition. There's something, and that is consistency in government policies. What are other fears that you may have as regards to successful realization of these plans?
So I think the Nigeria's commitment is articulated in something called the nationally determined contribution. I think the key thing as we approach, and you alluded to it earlier, this election year, is that all parties, all candidates who might come into office understand what those commitments are. They're not just commitments for this government, they're commitments for future governments.
Do you think they are aware of this commitment?
I think they are. I think the how to turn those commitments into action is a question for them. Each party might have a different way of doing that. But it's important they think about that, because that's what the commitment is from Nigeria. Every country that's made a commitment is looking that kind of 20, 30, 40 years ahead. It's a long time for any government to plan. It's unusual for anyone to plan that far ahead, but it's required. So I think it's really important that candidates coming in reflect on the consequences of those commitments, what it will mean for infrastructure, what it will mean for the investment climate. I think the second thing is to have an economy that's growing, that's able to have finance that can support these kind of shovel-ready projects. So again, changing the investment climate to improve it, to allow for increased investment, foreign direct investment, Nigerian investment, I think is really, really, really important.
Nigeria is gradually moving towards election next year. What would you say the basic understanding of the next president the country should be concerning climate and climate change?
I think any president coming into Nigeria has to deal with those two issues you alluded to, poverty and access to energy. And you know, I understand why those will be forefront in their minds. I guess as they approach the issue, they should think about access to energy in terms of sustainability. How do you make access to energy sustainable? Not just something that happens in the short term, but something which through renewable energy means that people in the furthest reaches of Nigeria who have no access to energy can have it into the foreseeable future. And that means, I think, fair enough, a transition from fossil fuels, but finding the kind of solutions that people can see 20, 30, 40 years ahead around renewable energy, off-grid energy. So I'm confident that there are excellent policymakers, and Nigeria is rich with that, but it's about really committing to those solutions.
Implementation of those policies.
Absolutely.
Let's take this short break. When we return, we'll go back to COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh. We'll talk about the impute of the African nations towards climate change, and what they really, really understand about climate change, whether you feel that they can comprehend this fully. We'll be right back. Stay here, Lagos.
The home of entertaining conversations.
I personally think Liverpool of last season that lost the title were better. That's my personal opinion.
Somebody who has the virus refused to isolate. That's even attempted murder, in my opinion, because you know how dangerous this virus is and you refuse to do the right thing. It should be a crime.
99.3.
A young man like me, looking for what I'll fed myself, and police are collecting my money.
Your number one station for talk, 99.3 Nigeria Info. Let's talk. Morning Crossfire on 99.3 Nigeria Info.
And we're back on the Crossfire, 99.3 Nigeria Info. I have the British Deputy High Commissioner in Lagos, Ben Llewelyn Jones, on the show today. And we're talking COP27, climate change conversation. And if you are a player in this field, please feel free to join our conversation this morning. We'll like an informed contribution on the show. 0700 993 993 993 and 01465 71904, the ladies to call. All righty. Mr. Ben, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. Let's head back to COP27, right? Holding a Sharm el-Sheikh. But let's listen to the UK Prime Minister first. When we listen to him, then I'll come back to you to come hear your thoughts on my next line of question this morning. So take a listen to this, then we'll continue our conversation.
Elizabeth II addressed COP26 last year. She reflected how history has shown that when nations come together in common cause, there is always room for hope. When we began our COP presidency, just one third of the global economy was signed up to net zero. Today, it is 90%. And for our part, the UK, which was the first major economy in the world to legislate for net zero, will fulfill our ambitious commitment to reduce emissions by at least 68% by 2030. And because there is no solution to climate change without protecting and restoring nature, in Glasgow, more than 140 countries, which are home to over 90% of the world's forests, made a historic promise to halt and reverse forest loss and land degradation by the end of this decade.
I mean, that part of the UK Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, really got me about, you know, restoring the forest. And that brings me to African countries where poverty is rife. People go to the forest to cut down trees just to be able to eat, to cook, to even do business, to live. And we have Sharm el-Sheikh, COP27 going on at Sharm el-Sheikh right now. African countries, you know, pledging their commitment, other nations pledging their commitment as well. And I'm here looking at them like, really? Would you be able to come through with this commitment with the poverty level, you know, on the continent?
Yeah, no, it is. Like, it's hugely challenging. And I think what we've seen with deforestation in Nigeria, it's partly around cooking. It's also partly around illegal shipment of wood outside of Nigeria. And of course, it destroys the biodiversity within the forests as well. And the pangolin, for example, one of the most endangered species in the world, being destroyed in Nigeria. So, I mean, there's a variety of things that could be done. I mean, firstly, on the illegal logging, you know, close work with the Nigerian Customs Service and others to try and prevent that, and also to prevent the illegal trafficking of wildlife. On forestry and deforestation, clean cooking, that's part of the solution.
Right.
So this is where, you know, we have to be pragmatic. So gas for clean cooking, for example, gas is it's not a net zero emissions energy source, but it's necessary. Gas
and part of dailies today.
Gas for clean cooking, essentially to try and help people have an alternative to charcoal, to wood.
Right.
And it's also safer. You know, it's not just about the deforestation. It's about the danger posed to people who are cooking on wood and indeed who are suffering kind of health impacts from that. So there are various initiatives that we're supporting that would support gas for clean cooking or alternatives, and indeed alternative energy sources away from gas. So, you know, renewable off-grid energy as well. But look, no one says it's easy. If it was easy, it would have been done by now.
That's right.
What's clear is it's necessary. And when it comes to reforestation, particularly when we look at the north of Nigeria and the Great Green Wall that's been intended but hasn't been created, it's so necessary as desertification creeps south, as we see more and more arid conditions. So I'm committed, and I believe what we've seen at COP27 is a recommitment of action to reforest and afforest, but also, I think, an acknowledgement that to do this in a way that helps the poorest, doesn't leave the poorest behind.
Right. Indeed. Talking about poorest, that's one thing. Another aspect of this climate change conversation is literacy, education, or what climate change is all about. In this part of the world, quite a number of people right now listening to us are wondering, what thing did they talk? Meaning, what are they talking about? What is climate change? In other words, what should Africans do in terms of educating the populace, telling them more, creating awareness, conversations, more conversations around climate change? Because I don't think we're doing that enough. And quite a number of people are not even aware there is something called climate change. The flooding that happened, they just felt, it was the Lagdo Dam that they opened. It was the Disting Dam that happened. They didn't know that climate change contributed, you know, to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a challenge. And I think helping people understand why things are happening. I mean, they're experiencing the impacts, that's for sure. No question. And it's always the poorest that feel the most difficult, most hard. I think helping people understand that what they can do can help to stop this. So plastics is always a good example to me. Mm. We see people using single-use plastics in Nigeria. Right. I understand, again, why that happens. They clog drains. When the flooding and the rain happens, it makes it harder, it makes it worse. Mm. You know, they themselves, plastics are, you know, production of plastics is a high-emitting industry. So trying to help people understand that through their consumer choice, they can not use single-use plastics. Mm. Impossible to avoid them completely, not saying that, but we can use fewer, we can dispose of them better, we can recycle them. It's just helping people to see the kind of link between what they do and what happens. But I think the important thing, and I'd say this very clearly, you know, Nigerians are part of the global population. It's what we do in the UK. It's what happens in the States, in China, in India, high-emitting places. Mm. We need to change our behaviours too. That's part of the solution.
Mm. Indeed. Now, let's wrap this up before we now go to other issues. Sure. What would you expect to see in Nigeria after COP27?
So after COP27, I think it has to be a passage of implementation. That's what we need to see. We've got a nationally determined contribution from Nigeria, that commitment to climate change, reducing climate change emissions. We've got what's called a climate change communication on adaptation from Nigeria, how to adapt Nigeria's infrastructure to the impacts of climate change. So it's about moving from that to where we build bridges, where we build roads, how we design financial instruments like insurance to protect public buildings, to protect private buildings, how we have climate resistant crops, how we make sure that more people can have energy access without producing high emissions. So I think implementation, I think for countries like Nigeria, you know, the theory's there, that's fine. It's about making happen what people said should, and holding to account countries like mine to make sure the climate finance is there. A very reasonable request. We need to help with that and others too. But implementation is the focus.
Mm, indeed. Let's move away from COP27 because we have very limited time left on the show and I have other areas that are... Tell us about the new advisory.
Right. So yesterday evening, we changed what we call our travel advice to British nationals. So we now no longer advise against all but essential travel to the Federal Capital Territory and Abuja. Some of you will recall on the 26th of October, we did put in place a travel advisory suggesting British nationals only travel to FCT and Abuja if their travel was essential. Mm. And this was to do with the threat of terrorism. Now, that threat's not gone away, no question. There is still a threat of terrorism across Nigeria in many states and indeed in FCT and Abuja. But we judge that risk to be slightly less.
Okay.
And importantly, we've moved our travel advice from what we call amber down to green. Okay. So it's a positive step. I mean, it's all credit to authorities who've taken action to try and reduce the threat, action that's been taken. But we need to be vigilant. We're not complacent. And all British nationals, and frankly, anyone who's traveling, needs to be vigilant about the threat of terrorism. That's still our advice.
How many states are we looking at now?
I'd have to check. I mean, our travel advice is online, so it's, and it's updated very readily. So, but the only change we made this yesterday was to remove FCT Abuja from that list of amber states. But www.gov.uk, you can see our travel advice.
You can see everything there.
Absolutely everything,
Still talking about security, though. I'd like to get your thought concerning some of the government officials coming out after, you know, your government issued that advisory, saying that you're creating panic and you're creating fear for Nigerians. How would you react to that?
So we believe in transparency. So in the UK, for example, we publish terror alerts and threats to alert the public. And really, it's about helping people make informed choices. So we're saying we can't stop people traveling. That's not what we do. We just say, if you're going to travel, be informed about the risks, be prepared, be part of the solution. If you see a bag that doesn't look right, you see something happening that doesn't look right, tell somebody, help the authorities. So helping people to make informed choices is what we do. And if there are heightened risks, as there are sometimes in the UK or other parts of the world, we want British nationals to be aware of that and to be able to prepare themselves for that travel and to be part of the solution. Mm. And, you know, these risks occur all over the world. We don't say they don't. They occur in the UK. We acknowledge that. We just want to be transparent and help people be prepared.
Mm. Talking about elections next year, I'm not going to ask you, you know, any serious questions. I just want to ask about, you know, public debate by candidates. Do you think it's essential part of the process?
I think it's really important that all candidates are able to be scrutinized by the media. This happens in the UK, happens in the US, happens across the world, to answer the questions that the media have and the public have. I think it's really important to So the public have an informed sense of what they're voting for. And I think in a modern democracy, in Nigeria, is a democracy moving in that direction. And indeed, voters want to see that kind of thing from their candidates. So, yeah, absolutely. I think it's important candidates expose themselves to scrutiny.
Indeed. Ben Llewelyn-Jones, has been awesome, amazing having you on the show. I can't take any more calls because of time. I mean, we have a lot to talk about, but we're just going to leave it here because I was going to ask you about one more thing,
please.
But I don't have the time. I would have loved to ask you, you know, but I don't have the time. Okay. I wanted to talk about the Ekweremadu and the case in court and all of that. But hey, I guess we'll have to shift that to some other time. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much. Always good. No, I'm very happy to come back.
Always a pleasure to have you. Ben Llewelyn-Jones is the British Deputy High Commissioner here in Lagos, Nigeria. We've been talking about COP27. If you've not been following up the conversation, please do. You can watch on YouTube if you can, and some other, you know, networks that do cover the COP27. It's a conversation that global leaders, you know, have regularly to talk about climate change and its impact on our lives, its existential impact on our lives as a people, as humans, not as Nigerians or British or Americans, as humans generally. So please follow up on that. I'm Sheriff Quadri. That's our show today, Lagos. I'll see you tomorrow. Good morning to you.